Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all up and out so early. At least it's early for some of the younger alumni, probably. We are very happy to have Sarah Brennis with us today. Sarah is a professor of Spanish and affiliated faculty in film and media studies and European studies. She arrived at Amherst in 2007 after earning her doctorate at the University of California, Berkeley. She is the author of two books, Genre Fusion, A New Approach to History, Fiction, and Memory in Contemporary Spain and Spaniards in Representations of a Nazi Concentration Camp, 1940 to 2015. In 2020, she also co-edited the volume Spain, the Second World War and the Holocaust, History and Representation with Gina Herman. Her research has appeared in various academic journals, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Magazine, and in podcasts for the New Books Network and Historias, the Spanish History Podcast. Sarah hails from Madison, Wisconsin, and lives right now in Northampton with her husband and two children. So thank you all very much, and please welcome Sarah Brennis.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Kim, for the introduction, and to everyone organizing the reunion programming for this invitation. It's the first time I'm doing a presentation for reunion, and I don't think I see anyone who's taken a class with me, but if I'm wrong, please tell me afterwards. I would love to reconnect. I have a presentation that's not as long as the hour that we've got allotted, so there's plenty of time for questions at the end. I'm just gonna time myself to make sure I don't go too far over. And I have some images that hopefully will help us kind of understand this fascinating story. So, let's go. In April 1941, Pablo Rodriguez García filed an inquiry with the Spanish Red Cross in Madrid. His son Carlos was missing. The last news he'd had was from November 1940, when he got word that Carlos was prisoner number 4286 in Mauthausen. 5 months later, the response arrived in September 12, 1941, and these are both images from the archives. Officious and brief, it confirmed Pablo's fears. It's in German, but the English translation is, "The German Red Cross wishes to inform you, after consulting with the proper organization, that Carlos Rodriguez Risco is located imprisoned in the Mauthausen camp near Linz, Upper Austria. Against all odds, Rodriguez del Risco would survive for 5 years in the Austrian Nazi concentration camp of Mauthausen. Although he left Spain as a Republican soldier fighting the rising tide of fascism in the Spanish Civil War, he returned an apologist for Adolf Hitler and a fervent supporter of Francisco Franco, a Falangist who had seemingly undergone a political conversion while a stateless prisoner in a Nazi camp. Despite the Franco regime's strict censorship and attempts to whitewash its support of the Axis powers, in 1946, Rodriguez del Risco would become the first Spaniard to publish an account in his home country of his years in exile. He was, in fact, among the very first voices in Europe from inside a Nazi concentration camp, publishing his memoir contemporaneously with Vladislav Bilsman's The Pianist, later made into a movie, Primo Levi's If This Is a Man, and Olga Lengel's Five Chimneys. These are all Holocaust memoirs of the concentration camp experiences from across Europe, published in the mid-40s, soon after liberation. Rodriguez del Risco's unsettling account of the inhospitable French refugee camps, the bloody battles against the Nazis with the French Foreign Legion, the forced POW marches through Germany, and 5 brutal years in a concentration camp was serialized for the Franco regime's official fascist newspaper, Arriba, under the headline, "I Was in Mauthausen," in 1946. He never surfaced again. Spain has increasingly been confronting the legacy of the 4-decade-long Franco regime over the past 20 years. The progressive coalition government, which was consolidated in December 2019, vowed to restore what they call democratic memory after efforts to confront past atrocities were put on ice by previous conservative governments. That commitment saw perhaps its most high-profile confrontation a few months before the leftist coalition found its footing with the disinterment of Franco's body from the Valley of the Fallen monument, which you can see on the left outside Madrid. And these are images from the live TV coverage that showed that process of disinterment and transfer. The dictator was laid to rest here at the Valley of the Fallen in 1975. Soon after, debates over past crimes and justice for his victims were also summarily buried. Spain's transition from a dictatorship to a democracy sidelined questions about regime-mandated violence and repression in what has commonly been considered a pact of silence, although it was also aided by an amnesty law that has never been repealed. The country sank into an official denial of its past, though scholars and activists point to the fact that the silence was really only at the governmental level, because many Spanish citizens have been clamoring for some sort of closure in many different ways in the nearly 50 years since Franco's death. One of the sticking points are the 10,000 Spaniards who were deported to Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Until only recently, the Spanish government has steadfastly refused to acknowledge these non-Jewish victims of Nazi violence. 80 years after the end of World War II, it still admits no fault for their deportation. They really remain shadows to victims of the Spanish Civil War, which have gotten a lot more attention inside and outside of Spain, even though these deportees fought in that conflict and suffered through it that period as well. But the deportees to Nazi concentration camps have fallen into something of a memory abyss when they crossed the border into another even larger war. So just to give us a little bit of background here, historians estimate between about 8,700 and 15,000 Spaniards were deported to Nazi camps during the war. And we don't have precise numbers for a couple of reasons. One, because although the Nazis kept very meticulous records, they tried to destroy the evidence as the war was in its waning days. So we don't have precise numbers for that reason, and also because the Franco regime had really no interest in tracking any of these people, not during the regime, and the efforts to track victims and survivors of the camps has been piecemeal since Franco's death. Just to clarify too, the deportees from Spain were political prisoners in the camps. They were not Jewish. And they were imprisoned as stateless enemies of Franco, which in and of itself is a contradiction in terms, right? They were obviously Spaniards and enemies of Franco, but they were considered stateless. And Franco was one of Hitler's allies. So Spaniards were deported throughout the Third Reich, the concentration camp system, but mainly to forced labor camps. Some of the camps where Spaniards were deported include Buchenwald, Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Flossenbürg, Ravensbrück, Neuengamme, Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Mauthausen. Mauthausen is right here in the middle. The majority of the Spanish deportees ended up in Mauthausen. And its system, this slide shows, its system of 60 sub-camps throughout Austria. Again, Mauthausen is in yellow here. So of the conservative estimate of about 9,000 Spaniards deported to concentration camps, about 7,200 ended up in Mauthausen. And of that number, only 23%, so about 2,200 people, survived the camp. The greatest number of Spaniards died in Gusen, a sub-camp just about 5 kilometers outside the main camp of Mauthausen. Gusen was really the deadliest camp in the Mauthausen system. So the Spanish prisoners were not subject to the policy of extermination that the Jews suffered. They were not killed for biological or ethnic reasons, and they were not sent to the gas chambers en masse as part of the Nazis' final solution. Instead, they were used as slave labor and died of different causes, all directly attributable to their treatment by the Nazis. In Mauthausen and Gusen and the other sub-camps you can see on this slide, they died of disease, starvation, exhaustion, extreme temperatures, but they were also shot, beaten, gassed, thrown off a high cliff that rings the camp's quarry, and also electrocuted on the high voltage fence that surrounded the camp. Other Spaniards survived, however, and many of the survivors were selected to work in an office or a kitchen, a garage, or a photo lab, an interior space, where they got slightly better rations and were out of the elements, and were also spared the back-breaking labor that many of their compatriots suffered in the camp's quarry or in other hard labor details. And so they were able to survive this small subset of the Spaniards until Mauthausen was liberated by the U.S. Army's 41st Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron, 11th Armored Division, on May 5th, 1945. And this picture is actually a recreation of that liberation moment. It happened probably on May 6th or May 7th when a group of survivors crowded around one of the U.S. Army tanks. And I just wanted to draw your attention to this banner that hangs, this is one of the interior gates of Mauthausen. It's a banner that one of the Spanish survivors created out of old bed sheets. It actually says in Spanish, "Los españoles antifascistas saludan a las fuerzas liberadoras." And then there's an English translation, which you can't see below it, and in Russian as well. So the Spanish anti-fascist salute the liberating forces. Carlos Rodriguez de Risco was one of these lucky few survivors who made it through 5 years in Mauthausen. His extraordinary memoir plainly contradicts the common conception in Spain that no one knew anything about the Spaniards who were deported to and killed in the camps during the severe years of the Franco dictatorship. In 34 installments between April 20th and June 1st, 1946, I was in Mauthausen. His harrowing first-person testimony of the fissures of war in Europe, the endless abuses and privations of the Nazis, and the bureaucratic tangles of a displaced person after the war was front-page news in the Spanish fascist press. And also, just to point out on this slide, you have up here the symbol of the Spanish fascist party based on the Italian phalange, the yoke and the arrows. This was the symbol of the Falange, which was the pseudo-fascist party, the only political party during Franco's regime in Spain. Writing these articles just months after the end of his ordeal in Mauthausen, Rodriguez del Risco provides a level of detail that no other Spanish concentration camp survivor can match. He describes with precision the inner workings of the camp and its organization, the nicknames of the prisoner capos, the identities, occupations, and birthplaces of scores of his countrymen, some of whom who have never subsequently been identified. The slave labor conditions that he and his compatriots were subjected to, and the most common tortures meted out by the SS. He brings what I think is a scientific level of detail to this text in that he measures out the exact amount of the lethal poison that the Nazi pseudo-doctors injected in their medical experiments on prisoners. He gives us the exact square meters of the barracks. He even calculates the temperature that the thermometer dropped to during the harsh Austrian winters. Rodriguez de Risco was a sailor in the Spanish Navy from a military family, but in his account, he becomes a military historian, a political scientist, an armchair journalist. With the confidence of somebody who's just lived through the events in question, his narrative captures the major players, the petty conflicts, and the seismic shifts in wartime Europe. He also really details Spain's implication in the Second World War and the Holocaust. The author himself is the primary evidence. He was a man who was on the front lines with the French Foreign Legion, battling back the Nazis during the war. And he would later in the camps see convoys of Jewish prisoners arrive in Mauthausen. He would see the tortures that they were subjected to from the SS, and then he would note that they would all disappear just a few hours later, killed. So it's for all of these reasons that the flip side of this memoir is so startling. For a person who's just managed to survive 5 years in a concentration camp to actually implicate the prisoner capos and the SS in the execution of the Nazis' pogrom, instead of the Nazi high command and Hitler himself, is sensationalist in its fallacy. And for someone who actually witnessed the persecution of Jews with his own eyes to then write hateful anti-Semitic diatribes is very disturbing. And for a man who actually fled the Franco regime, afraid for his life in a boat full of refugees, to then pledge his loyalty to the very same dictator who essentially caused his deportation is jarring. And in fact, the title of this talk, That Extraordinary Man, does not refer to Carlos Rodriguez de Risco. In fact, those are the words he used to describe Hitler. He says in this long paragraph talking about Adolf Hitler, that man, without any doubt extraordinary, could not and should never have, in my judgment, known the true and sad reality of the Dantesque horrors in the concentration camp. The incongruous observations from the mouth of a concentration camp survivor that Hitler had no knowledge of the camps is difficult to parse, though not unprecedented. They really anticipate a level of Holocaust denial that would become more prevalent in the years to come, and indeed is still prevalent today. Spain was officially non-belligerent during the Second World War, but in reality, the country was never neutral. Hitler and Mussolini sent guns and troops to the rebels during the Spanish Civil War, and Franco reciprocated by sending war material, including wolfram, back to Germany. Franco sought to curry Hitler's favor, and he sat down to negotiate the parameters of Spain's entry into the war with the Führer in October 1940. These are the images that you're seeing from a German newsreel from that time period of this meeting between Franco on the right and Hitler, obviously, on the left. Spain never formally entered the war, yet the Spanish dictator imposed Byzantine restrictions on Jews seeking to escape Nazi genocide through Spain, and left Spanish Sephardic Jews, who were legally Spanish citizens, isolated and vulnerable outside the Iberian Peninsula. Although he didn't outwardly support Hitler's pogrom against European Jewry, Franco did nothing to stop it. Anti-Semitic references to Judeo-Masonic Bolshevik conspiracy really littered the Francoist propaganda during the Second World War. We don't actually know what was discussed in this train car, but there's been a lot of speculation. But really, the evidence is clear that Franco and Hitler had a relationship. By 1946, however, under the Allies' post-war European realignment, Franco had disavowed any allegiance to Hitler and was beginning to polish a myth that his regime had actually made a humanitarian effort on behalf of the Jews of Europe. That year, just a year after the end of the war, Franco dropped the Nazi salute, which was in common usage in Francoist rallies, etc., in Spain. He fired all of his fascist ministers and replaced them with loyal Catholic technocrats. But nevertheless, the United Nations was unmoved. That year, in 1946, a little bit later, the UN General Assembly voted to exclude Spain, a move that really catalyzed the Franco regime's efforts to whitewash its legacy regarding the Jews. So Rodriguez de Risco's exculpation of Hitler in his memoir for the genocide of Jews seems to have been published at a moment when the regime was still trying to get its story straight. Franco's censorship apparatus was absolutely strict, but it seemed to give Arriba a free pass because it was the regime's newspaper, and Franco himself wrote for this paper under three different pseudonyms. But there are other elements of these articles that you can sort of understand as buoying the Franco regime. The author writes about the Generalissimo's vital generosity to the destitute Spanish people, and Spain's Catholic morality in something of an effort to try to convince or try to sway the international powers to allow Spain to rejoin the global community, which would happen in a few more years. In the first installment of his articles, Rodriguez de Risco pledges his absolute loyalty to Franco. And in the last, he calls himself, as you can see on this slide, Catholic by conviction, I'm a soldier of the church, fervent Spaniard, I will always be a loyal servant to my homeland. And my homeland is today, whether the communists and renegades like it or not, unanimously represented by Franco, a man providentially chosen to save it from the most formidable catastrophe of all time. Rodriguez Arrisco props up his bona fides, his pro-Franco and Catholic bona fides like bookends, and he channels the regime's new line, underlying Spain's moral purity and distancing himself and his country from the Nazis. But in the first installment of these articles, he also writes and records really the unmentionable fact that Spaniards figured among victims of the concentration camps. His editor writes, quote, "De Risco calculates 10,000 Spaniards who died over the course of 5 years," and the numbers aren't that far off. The Spaniards, he writes, died in many ways, quote, "hunger, squalor, abuses, escape attempts, some horrific, electrified barbed wire, showers that finished a man off." Although he didn't see the gas chambers, he knew that they existed in Mauthausen. And so just like that, only a year, really only a few months after Liberation Day, the muzzled Spanish press broke an essential fact. A year later, Spaniards, not just Jews, died in the concentration camps. So this tale, which the editor billed, you can see up here, as 7 years of adventure in exile, was unlike anything that had appeared in the Spanish press up till that time. It revealed names, dates, identifying details of the victims, as well as their torturers, that have now, decades later, been corroborated by survivors, historians, journalists, and family members. What's more, as I mentioned before, Rodriguez Arrisco mentions some people who've been lost to history, who really don't appear in any of the subsequent databases at all. So these articles are really groundbreaking, but they had no impact. No subsequent historian of the Nazi camps references them. No survivor mentions Carlos from Catalonia in their own memoirs. If this story had ended with one man's account of resistance in the face of Nazi evil published in the pages of a Madrid newspaper for all the world to see, Rodriguez Arrisco probably would have become another Primo Levi or Jorge Semprún, who are real noted Holocaust writers and survivors. But Carlos Rodriguez Arrisco and his editor did not limit themselves to merely accounting for Spanish deportees to a Nazi concentration camp. If they had, in fact, these articles would never have seen the light of day. They never would have been published. Instead, Rodriguez Arrisco veered out of his lane, and he mixes a laundry list of pro-Hitler, denialist, anti-Semitic diatribes into his first-person accounting. According to the author, Hitler is a true patriot. The SS, he says, completely independent of Hitler, orchestrated the violence in the camps. The prisoner capos were the real bosses, according to the author. Petain, the French head of state, who was a collaborationist, Vichy France, he calls Petain a fervent Catholic and a sincere patriot. And he also thinks that the general Franco, is so magnanimous that, according to the author, 90% of the Spanish Republican deportees would return to Spain in an instant to enjoy peace, order, and the love of their family, if not for the degrading effects of anti-Franco propaganda abroad. And finally, perhaps most disturbing about these articles is the anti-Semitic threads. He calls the Jews, quote, "hypocrites, fakes, and egotists, prone to turn on one another." Perhaps for many of these reasons, Carlos Rodriguez and his articles disappeared, faded away after their publication. And a full accounting of this history, of this story of the Spaniards in Mauthausen, would really take another 30 years to come to light. Only once Franco died in 1975 and the censorship loosened, survivors felt that they weren't under threat of reprisals to talk about their stories, only at that point would scholars and journalists begin to pick up this story and really start to study the trajectory of the thousands of Spaniards who were deported and killed in Mauthausen. From this moment to today, from 1975 today, what was sort of a trickle of memory has become a tidal wave of memory, including survivor memoirs, sensationalist paperbacks, documentaries, journalism, fiction, movies, TV series, graphic novels, and even social media accounts. This slide is really just the memoirs that came out in the last decade of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st, but there's a lot more material out there. But among all of this very self-referential body of memory work over the last 8 decades, Rodriguez de Risco's name never comes up, not once. He's been effectively erased from the historical memory of the deportation. Which begs the question, why am I talking about him now? How am I talking about him now? How did I find him? I have an answer for that. So about 10 years ago, I was working in the Spanish National Library in Madrid, and I stumbled on this, the original newsprint clippings of these articles. They're mounted in a box, you can see with these grommets, upside down, backwards, out of order. And when you look at them more closely, the National Library's copy, this original copy, is missing a number of the more propagandistic entries, the entry about Hitler, some of the entries about Petain, a number of the ones that we would find fairly flagrantly false. It wasn't until that I looked at the microfilm, I found some of the originals, but then in 2019, I was working with a team of Amherst College researchers, we know how smart they are, and this young man, Konstantin Laren, was going through the Arriba microfilm over at Frost, and he discovered that not only were some of the more propagandistic entries censored, he found the first 5 entries in the articles that I was unaware that they had even existed. So I thought a story that picked up in the middle of World War II with Carlos fighting back the Nazis along the Moselle River actually started years earlier. The articles actually covered his whole escape from Spain and, you know, his trials and tribulations as a refugee in 1939. Needless to say, Konstantin earned 1 million extra credit points that day because that was a huge discovery. It really broke open what I was working on. So the story of how this incomplete, backwards, upside down, censored version of this article got to the National Library in Spain, in Madrid, is actually quite fascinating. And it folds in the Francoist secret police and Spain's nefarious wartime Department of Judaism into this story. So this man, Eduardo Comín Colomer, now you need to hear a little bit about him. He was a journalist and a fervent anti-Republican Catholic before the Civil War. He rose through the pro-Franco Police Intelligence Service to reach director of the so-called Department of Judaism at the National Security Service headquarters in 1938. This Department of Judaism, is the same office that ordered the civil governors of the provinces of Spain to create what was called a Jewish archive of all the national and foreign Jews living on Spanish soil in 1941. And although scholars have not actually been able to find the resulting list, its mere existence posed an existential threat to Jews in Spain. And it's one more piece of evidence that the Franco regime was anything but neutral. So this man, Eduardo Colomín Colomer, he didn't limit himself to secret intelligence. He was also a prolific author and collector of Francoist propaganda. And in the 1940s, his bibliophile hobby came to dovetail with his work on the regime's police intelligence sector. Comín Colomer confiscated books, pamphlets, and articles on subversive topics. You can see kind of a collection here. When he conducted raids on the homes of exiles or detainees under investigation, and he added them to his collection. So at the time of his death in 1974, his various interests, namely police intelligence, dissent, anti-Semitism, and surveillance, came together in the form of a generous donation to the National Library in Spain. And here you can see, this is right from the first article on that previous slide. There's his name, Comín. These articles were donated by his widow. So he collected these original newsprints, and my hypothesis is that he was probably the one who was snipping the articles out of his morning fascist newspaper to collect them, leaving out a few that struck him as politically uncouth. I think he probably would have wanted to spare his fellow Francoist bookworms the anti-Semitic and pro-Hitler diatribes, which in 1946 Spain, and especially in 1974 Spain, would have been completely out of date. So this former state security agent who was accustomed to snagging treatises on communism and masonry in the homes of his enemies, managed to pull off one last act of state-sponsored censorship when his widow donated his carefully curated collection. So when I first started writing about Rodriguez de Risco 10 years ago, people challenged me that he even existed. I got a lot of pushback, in fact, trying to publish this research and present it at different conferences. One of the problems was that his hometown has no birth certificate for him. And another was that he invented his birthplace in the French refugee camp records, which honestly was not that uncommon. But his name does clearly appear in two very important documents. And the one on the left is the entry registry for Mauthausen, taken by the Nazi scribes. And you can see his name here with that number, 4286, that we saw at the beginning of the slides. So this would have been his entry written down in 1940 when he entered the camp. And the document on the right was a typewritten list of survivors kept by another Spaniard who worked in the inner offices of Mauthausen. He was also a scribe, but a prisoner scribe. And here you can see Rodriguez de Risco also appears on this list. Same number. So, well, his number doesn't appear here, but the same information that we saw. Oh, there it is, his number right there. So we do have evidence of his existence. But that being said, we also know that there are lots of other people, a not insignificant number of people, who have invented their experiences in Nazi camps out of whole cloth. And I want to mention one because it's an interesting part of this story. In Spain, the most renowned of these imposters is Enrique Marco, this man, who was the subject of a really disquieting book, but fascinating book about his charade as a Flossenbürg survivor by Javier Cercas, who's one of Spain's most famous novelists. I have a few issues with this book, but nevertheless, it's a fascinating read, and it is in English translation if you're interested. But it really wasn't until recently, right before the pandemic broke, that I enlisted the help of a historian friend in Catalonia, and we managed to secure irrefutable proof that Carlos Rodriguez de Risco existed. We found his daughter, Luisa, who's still alive. And with her clear firsthand memories of her father, she in fact remembers seeing the notebooks where he wrote his memoir. She also has family photos of him. And we also found Rodriguez de Risco's baptismal certificate, which does prove his birth, and his death certificate from 1959. So with all these pieces of information, I was finally able to put this puzzle together. Spain has been agonizingly slow to recognize its victims and survivors of Nazi concentration camps. A partial list of Spaniards killed in Mauthausen was only published in the official state bulletin in 2019. This very small, very hard to find monument was inaugurated in Madrid only in January 2020. It's the only monument in the seat of the Spanish government. And the last Mauthausen survivor died in October 2020, the last Spanish Mauthausen survivor. So at this point, it's fallen to family members, journalists, and activists to advocate for the Spanish deportees and their legacy. As recently as February of 2020, a group of family members signed on to a decade-old lawsuit denouncing Francoist crimes. And really what they're demanding is an admission from the Franco government, for the Spanish government, the current democratic government, that it was complicit in the deportation of Spanish nationals to Nazi camps during the Franco regime. But the lawsuit was filed in Argentina, because in Spain, this kind of what some might consider opening old wounds has not been particularly accessible in the judicial system. There are a number of obstacles to bringing these kinds of international human rights cases in the judicial system in Spain. So they filed it in Argentina. But meanwhile, public consciousness about the Spanish deportees is growing, even though the majority of Spanish high school students will never learn about this history. In fact, you all probably know more now than the average Spanish high school student does. There are a few things that have happened. We now have a feature-length film that you can watch on Netflix about the survivor Francesc Boix, called The Photographer of Mauthausen, along with, I mentioned before, Twitter accounts, graphic novels, a number of other kinds of media that recreate the voices of the victims and are really positioned to try to reach a new generation of Spaniards. And firsthand accounts also continue to trickle out as people make discoveries in their family archives and dust off long forgotten manuscripts, even though there are no Spanish survivors still alive, as I mentioned. But what unites this tide of activism and memory making is sort of a deference to what we consider the typical Spanish concentration camp survivor. The typical survivor is a staunch anti-fascist, fought against Franco, supported the democratically elected government of Spain, and most of them never went back to Spain during Franco's lifetime. They were lifelong exiles. I put a few pictures here that really represent that kind of what we might think of as the normative concentration camp survivor from Spain. This person on the left is Francisco Boix, the person who has inspired the film on Netflix. He was a photographer and managed to take a number of photographs and save a number of photographs from inside Mauthausen. Very committed to the anti-fascist cause and attempted to save evidence to really use at the Nuremberg trials, actually. He was the only Spaniard who appeared at the Nuremberg trials. And this is a photo that he himself took after the liberation of Mauthausen of Spanish survivors in Gusen. And then this final photo over here is one that I took at one of the yearly commemorations that are held at the Mauthausen camp itself. It's now a memorial site. Yearly busloads of Spanish family members, some high school students managed to make this trip to commemorate the legacy of the Spanish victims and survivors in Mauthausen. So this I would consider sort of the typical trajectory, still remembering the anti-fascist cause, very committed to being in community with survivors. But Rodriguez de Risco was a Republican turncoat. He was an anti-Semitic fascist sympathizer who returned to Spain, unlike most of his compatriots, and cut ties with his fellow survivors. When his hometown south of Barcelona erected a monument to its hometown native anti-fascist resistors and concentration camp victims in 2001, Carlos Rodriguez de Risco's name does not appear. And even with proof of his existence now, 20 years later, the town's Democratic Memory Council is trying to come to terms with how, whether, and if, or where to memorialize Carlos Rodriguez de Risco. And to be honest, I'm trying to help them figure this out. I've also been working on publishing a critical edition of these memoirs. And to be very frank, it's been extremely difficult to find anyone in Spain open to publishing this memoir, even with the contextual information that I've given to you sort of in digest form. I've come up with some resistance to bringing this out into the world. In a recent New York Times op-ed, the historian Jan Grabowski wrote about what he called memory patches that cover over the genocide of Jews by memorializing the righteous but isolated actions of a few individuals. With growing anti-Semitism and nationalism in Spain and the rest of Europe, not to mention the United States, coupled with a tendency toward Holocaust distortion, memorializing this survivor without any context about the larger paradox that constitutes his case could obviously risk glorifying his anti-Semitic and pro-Franco tendencies. But on the other hand, his contribution to the history of this exile movement in 1939, the Spanish implication in World War II, and the deportation is really unparalleled. As we move into the third decade of the 21st century, debating academic freedom and free speech in the context of rising anti-Semitism, extremist groups, and hate crimes, we're at a crossroads. In this era, with Spain's far-right party Vox increasingly resonating with voters who imagine that Franco's regime was not so bad, and Holocaust deniers who continue unabated, one anomalous survivor story brings us face to face with how elements of fascism can be nurtured even under the most unlikely of circumstances. As a friend and Catalan sociologist Marta Simó put it to me, there is no vaccine against anti-Semitism and denialism, not even having survived 5 years in a Nazi concentration camp. in my opinion, stories like this one, like Rodriguez del Risco's, are valuable. They're at the margins of history, but they allow us to really look at the past in its molecular, individualized form, and not just as a faceless tide of humanity. So I think that we need to reckon with the fact that there's no one-size-fits-all concentration camp survivor. Seeing also the exile condition through different lenses deepens how we imagine the refugee experience. It's not an undulating, faceless exodus. It's a conglomeration of individuals with distinct identities, their own political biases, and they may challenge our preconceptions and rupture what we think of as this idealized heroic narrative that really tends to prevail and feed some of the more ahistorical accounts, certainly of the Holocaust. We've all seen or most likely heard of some of these accounts, like The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, which is a book and a film. Even Life is Beautiful, the film, Sarah's Key. There's a proliferation of Holocaust narratives that are not based necessarily in fact. Carlos Rodriguez del Risco's story, in all its flaws and contradictions, brings us closer to an essential truth, that in between the folds of history lie individuals with unique experiences and beliefs. Rarely do any of them have the chance to make themselves heard. Yet understanding their experiences deepens our connection to the past by viewing history through the lens of the people who live to tell about it. I think that Rodriguez del Risco's memoir is a conduit to a past lived by a passionate man who was simply not immune to contradiction, misinformation, and prejudice during a charged period of authoritarian and fascist rule. Something that resonates with us today. He had an acute eye for detail, and he had a foresight into the value of his impressions of a conflict that upended the world. He probably could hardly imagine how far his recollections would travel. And just in closing, if you're interested in anything that I talked about today, any of the details, I can recommend a couple of books. This is pure self-promotion. Both of these came out with the University of Toronto Press. And I delve into more details about Spain's legacy in relation to World War II and the Holocaust in both of them. But I want to thank you again so much for your kind attention. We've got plenty of time, so I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have. Thanks so much. I'm doing this myself. I have no moderator, so please. Yeah, are both sides of the Civil War buried at the Valley of the Fallen? There are a number of victims of both sides of the Civil War, but the people who built this monument were mostly forced laborers on the Republican side, some of whom in fact died there and then were buried there. It was built as an homage to the nationalists, the Francoist victors, but the Republicans, or the people who were anti-Franco, who were buried there, were mostly buried there, not of their own or their family's wishes. Did you have another?
What did they do with Franco?
Franco is off in a private cemetery. It's a private cemetery that's still accessible to the public, where other members of the Franco family are buried, much to the consternation of many people on the left who would have preferred that his grave not be open to the public to be visited, because there were a lot of, and still are, many pro or extreme right demonstrations that happened at the Valley of the Fallen, continue to happen, and now happen at Franco's grave. Yeah. Right, so the question is, the Franco regime had plenty of its own concentration camps and prisoner of war or sort of labor camps. Why did they deport to the Nazi camps? And that's a great question, and absolutely you're correct. There were hundreds of camps that, in Spain, they're known as concentration camps. I try to avoid that term because it conflates them with the Nazi camps, but there were hundreds of camps in Spain for the losers, essentially, of the Spanish Civil War. But the people who ended up in the Nazi camps were the ones who fled Spain and who managed to evade, you know, a lot of people. There were about 500,000 refugees who crossed the border from Spain into France in 1939. Many of them were able to move on to Latin America or the US or elsewhere in Europe. Others returned. Some of those who returned voluntarily ended up in the camps in Spain. And then others went, when they were in the French refugee camps, volunteered because that was kind of one of their only ways to escape the refugee camps, which were by all accounts horrible. They volunteered to fight against the Nazis. And it was that part of their trajectory. So they were in marching battalions, they were in the French Foreign Legion as this man was. They were in these work companies that like worked on the different installations, Allied installations, but it was because they were fighting in World War II that when they were captured and when France fell, they were then in the possession of the Nazis. And so Franco, he had a number of memos that were sent from the State Department in Germany. We've got these Spaniards, what do you want us to do with them? And he just didn't respond. And that kind of conscious neglect or omission was what sent them to the camps, to the Nazi camps. Yeah.
I have a twofold question. Do you come to this as a historian, a professor of Spanish language? That's number one. Mm-hmm.
Great questions. Okay, two-part question. One, what is my angle here? A Spanish historian, Spanish language person, or Jew? None of the above. I'm not Jewish. I'm not actually trained as a historian. I think there's a historian or two in the room, but I come to it as a cultural historian, essentially. I studied Spanish literature and culture, but got fascinated with this particular topic when I was writing my dissertation, and I don't pretend to be a historian, although I love historians. I love studying history, and I love the tools of historical research. So working in the archives has really been how I've constructed this cultural history. And the second question, well, you have to remind me now. I went off. Were they conversos? There were some of them conversos. They may have been. In fact, I wanted to kind of separate these political prisoners from Sephardic Jews because there were Sephardic Jews in the camps. It's entirely possible that some of these Spanish Republicans were conversos and had Jewish heritage. Although, from what I've found, that didn't end up being the identifying factor or the factor that sped their abuse or their death in the camps. It was really because they were enemies of Franco. Ergo, enemies of Hitler, and then, as I mentioned before, simply disowned by the Spanish state. But there were Sephardic Jews, and there are some interesting stories of Sephardic Jews in the camp speaking Sephardi and hearing Spanish, and there's really some amazing connections that actually people who discovered another aspect of their Spanish identity and their cultural history in these camps by encountering Sephardic Jews. Yeah. Thank you. These are great questions. Yes. Okay.
I'm hearing that he turns out to be an anti-Semite. Did you go back and was he part of anti-Semitic Spain before the war and he just never lost that? Or do you think he became an anti-Semite as a result of being in a country?
Yeah. This is a great question. So backtrack. Why? How did he develop his anti-Semitic tendencies? It's unclear. He was not a member of any kind of anti-Semitic group, but he chafed against the Spanish military. He didn't like the Spanish democratic government, the Republican government. He was jailed, in fact, a few times in military prisons because he questioned authority. There's a larger story to this. His family was military. His family seemed pretty conservative, and he himself. So he was a Republican in name, and he fought with the Republican army. He fought on that side of the Spanish Civil War, but he seems to not have been a particularly you know, he wasn't particularly enraptured by the Republican democratic philosophy. Where does the anti-Semitism come from? Partially from that era in Spain. I mean, Spain has a long tradition of anti-Semitism stemming from the Inquisition, but and not a lot of Jews left, although a few, as I mentioned, enough that the Franco government felt the need to track the ones that were still there. But there was a lot of anti-Semitic propaganda circulating more after the Spanish Civil War, but to a certain extent, a little bit during that period, a little bit in the 20s, and then it exploded during the Second World War. So anti-Semitic, you know, as I said, Franco considered the Jews one of his enemies. It's hard to know exactly how he, obviously it's one of those sort of alignments with Hitler. There were so few Jews in Spain that this is just a fallacy. I think it's a combination of factors, but I also think there were a few people in the camps who write later have some anti-Semitic leanings, and I think it just somehow blossomed during his time in the camp. And finally, I think when he wrote his memoirs, I don't think anybody put a gun to his head and said, you need to write it this way. But I think there was some influence, editorial influence, that may have encouraged him to paint the Jews in the camps in an anti-Semitic light. But I think ultimately those were his own beliefs that were just nurtured by anti-Semitism in Spain, especially during the war and in the immediate post-war. But that's a great question. I think we have time for a couple more if anyone else has another question. Yeah.
Can we know if this man had a sincere conversion of ideas, or if he was an opportunist, basically taking advantage of things? Because I think in many other characters from the Second World War, we fall into that second thing, the cynical opportunity.
Right. Yeah, this is a great question too. Where does this turncoat phenomenon come from with him? Is it political opportunism? Yes, I think it is. And in fact, that it was helpful to talk to his daughter about this. It's a very touchy subject to talk to a survivor's daughter and ask, was your dad really a fascist? But she said, listen, a lot of people changed jackets in the post-war time. He came back from the camps. He formed a family, and he wanted to make his way. He wanted to be able to be employed in Francoist Spain. So did he really subscribe to those beliefs as stunningly as he does in these articles? It's hard to say. I think, as I said before, I think he was a conservative man. She's sent me some material about his, you know, his faith and he was a very Catholic, as he says, fervent Catholic. But I think he was an opportunist in the sense that he was trying to, make a living for himself in 1940s Spain and 1950s Spain. She also says that when he died, their family rarely talked about him. She knew very little about his history after that, and the family. She doesn't strike me as someone who subscribes to those beliefs at all. But there were a lot of people who had those kind of turncoat moments, and Franco was one of them too. As I mentioned, he was all about political opportunism, so it was not rare in that period. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I've had a lot of trouble answering that question. Why did Ariba publish these stories? What was their, you know, what was the upshot for them? I think it was, Ariba had a lot of sensationalist news stories. I think they were looking for readers, and I think it was a way to pull in a readership that they could then slip in the anti-Semitic and pro-Francoist propaganda. But I think it was, you know, I don't have a definitive answer for this. I have never been able to encounter any reviews of the articles or any reader responses. And I haven't been able to find the censored articles themselves, although I have looked for them in the archives. So I don't know the answer to the question definitively, but I think it was this sort of, you know, twofold, bring them in and then use this story, which, you know, is fascinating to us now. It was fascinating to readers then. Use it to sort of paint a particular portrait of wartime Europe and Spain's role that was propagandistic to its readership. And that was the ultimate goal of Arriba, was pro-Franco propaganda. So it did help them in that sense. But it is startling because no one else covered the camps. People who didn't read these articles did not know that family members were in the camps. Many didn't find out until many years later because it was not front page news. Our time is up, and I want you to be able to go to your next session. These were the best questions I've ever gotten, and I am not surprised, from a room of Amherst alums and their families. So thank you so much again for your attention and for coming. I'll stick around. If anyone has any other questions, they can come up. Thank you.